Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. Several years after the attacks of September 11th, President George W. Bush visited a San Diego naval station and gave a speech. In it, he said, "Once again, war came to our shores with a surprise attack that killed thousands in cold blood. And once again, we will not rest until victory is America's and our freedom is secure."
Bush's "once again" phrasing was in reference to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. It was a deliberate use of language frequently heard in the months and years after the 9/11 attacks gave way to the Iraq War.
And to John Dower's ears, the Pearl Harbor reference meant something more. Dower is a professor emeritus of history at MIT and a Pulitzer Prize-winning author. In his book, Cultures of War, he draws the disturbing lines that connect what he calls a human propensity for war and folly.
When we spoke with him recently, Dower began by describing how after the 9/11 attacks, the comparisons to Pearl Harbor began immediately, just days after the attacks.
Many, many newspapers in the U.S. used infamy, day of infamy, or some variation on that as their immediate headline. I think it's the way people need to connect the present to something familiar. But that immediately spilled over into comparisons to Japan. And as a historian of U.S. and Japan in World War II, the comparisons or the attempted comparisons were fascinating. For example, they immediately went from infamy to kamikaze attack, that this was a kamikaze attack, which is, of course, Japan in World War II, although it had nothing to do with Pearl Harbor because the kamikaze came late in the war. 1944, they were introduced. And then you suddenly had the famous photo of the fireman in the ruins of the World Trade Center that became a postage stamp that was immediately put next to the famous photo of the raising of the flag on Iwo Jima. Many people actually put the two photos up together.
Oh, the firemen were raising the flag.
The firemen were raising the flag, and this was a sign of American resilience, recovery, determination, heroism.
It doesn't seem very surprising, though, that that would be the case, given the fact that, you know, at the most basic level, both attacks came, you know, out of a clear blue sky on an unprepared, unsuspecting nation.
That's correct. I don't think it was surprising. As the years passed, after 9/11 bled into the invasion of Iraq, after we see the insurgency erupting in Iraq, the Bush administration kept playing on the analogies to Japan so that several years later, on the anniversary of the victory over Japan, what we sometimes call VJ Day, years later, Bush gives a speech comparing once again the attack on December 7th to what he had experienced on 9/11. And basically, these were very misleading analogies.
Is that why you write in the book that, in your words, the greatest boomerang of Pearl Harbor is that terrorism could be defeated with brute force, just as the Axis powers were in World War II?
The administration was accustomed to thinking in conflicts between states, which is not unexpected, but they simply were not prepared to respond to attack by non-state actors. And the initial great miscalculation was that non-state actors were incompetent, didn't have the capabilities of taking on the U.S., and should they take on the U.S., they would simply be crushed by our overwhelming power. And it was a very effective way of linking the American populace behind the war. You know, there was this, I mentioned a big side of the highway advertisement in Chicago, in the expressway around Chicago, which said on one side, December 7, 1941, on the other side, 9/11, 2001, and in the middle, "We will never forget." And this notion that you could respond with, and the phrase comes out very clearly in the build-up then to Iraq, we're going to respond to terror by attacking Iraq, and we're going to win the war on terror through shock and awe.
Mm-hmm.
And the shock and awe concept is a Pentagon concept and goes right back to World War II. You can trace it. I mean, this is very explicit. It goes back to doctrine in the Pentagon. And shock and awe doctrine ultimately is premised on the experience of Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
When you first heard that the site of the World Trade Center was being called Ground Zero, what was your reaction?
Well, that came very hard on the heels of infamy. So Ground Zero, the phrase comes from the atomic bombs in the first. So it's a nuclear word, and it's the first use of nuclear weapons of mass destruction against civilians.
Did you think it was a fair or appropriate use to use that term in, for the
site
in New York City?
Well, when the term came out, what struck me was Americans were shocked by the atrocity on 9/11, and absolutely all of us were shocked. I mean, it was an atrocity. And then they used the word Ground Zero, and I said, well, here's a clear link now to history. But no one ever, it was like the word had been appropriated without any thought of where it came from, and now it's the Americans who are victims of a deliberate bombing of or attack on a civilian population. In fact, deliberately targeting civilians is standard operating procedure ever since the air wars of World War II.
And in fact, you say that it reached its apogee in World War II with the firebombing of
Dresden. It reaches
firebombing
its apogee in World War II. So the words that we were using, weapons of mass destruction, Ground Zero, shock and awe, which comes from the Hiroshima and Nagasaki, in the modern world and in modern war, and reaching its apogee in the air war in World War II, conducted by the British and the Americans, for psychological reasons, in psychological warfare, one of the targets is the morale of the enemy, and one of the ways of destroying enemy morale is to target civilian centers and individuals. So if you go back to Japan, this is a strategy that the Americans carried out in 64 cities before Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And the numbers aren't clear, but the number of Japanese civilians deliberately targeted in World War II is somewhere between 400,000 and 600,000 were killed in World War II. Hiroshima and Nagasaki are the horrendous capstones of this. To take the word Ground Zero and put it on the World Trade Center captures how ghastly this is, but it was done without the slightest sense of reflection that this is standard operating procedure in psychological warfare. You know, at one point, when I started to read about these matters, I was reading about World War II before Pearl Harbor, when the Germans and the Japanese were bombing civilians. America, Britain, Roosevelt, Churchill, the League of Nations, the Western world was appalled. And they said, this is beyond the pale of civilization. This is how we know the Germans and Japanese are savages. And it was heartfelt critique. Civilized people do not deliberately target civilians. After Pearl Harbor, after the blitz against England, the British and the Americans began to adopt the tactic of bombing civilians because they said this is necessary to destroy the morale of the enemy. By the time you get to Japan, it begins in March 1945, they simply send hundreds of planes low over Tokyo and destroy 14 square miles of Tokyo and kill in one raid about 100,000 people. In the process, moral men, reasonable men, rationalize that this is a necessary evil. And, you know, if I had been living then and been a part of that decision process, I see no reason to think I would have said, wait a minute, we used to say only barbaric people do it. Now we're rationalizing it as necessary and just. If you go back into the Islamist terrorists who support al-Qaeda, you will find them making just war arguments, making arguments about why this is unfortunate but necessary in our holy war. And then you get into a resonance of holy war language, just war language, necessary evil for a larger cause. And what interests me is the fact that this is the way we rationalize our holy wars, we modern human beings.
I think this is the point at which many listeners might take a step back and say, you know, Professor Dauer, the lines of linkage that you're drawing between these events in history are compelling. But on the other hand, the major issue in World War II was that a war actually had been declared between nations. There was a very active, hot war going on, whereas the attack on September 11th, no formal war had been declared.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair response. And I'm not trying to say that these things are analogous. In fact, in the book, I go to great length to show how they are different. But in the end, you are faced with the fact we're talking about deliberately targeting civilians as a necessary act, even a necessary evil, to obtain our what we believe are just and even holy objectives in war. And this is a phenomenon that isn't peculiar to Islamist fundamentalists. And in fact, what comes out in the writings about 10 years after 9/11, you will have all sorts of people saying, these Islamists don't respect human life like we Christians and Jews respect human life. And that simply is a false statement. So what I'm trying to get at, and that's the title of the book, comes with the fact that these are cultures of our modern wars. These are cultures of our modern wars, and we're practicing them. And to just simply use this Manichaean good us, evil them is a very false dichotomy.
There's a theme that runs throughout your book that you raise quite early, and that is how irrationality plays through all these historical events. I remember one of the most common questions in the days and weeks and months after September 11th was, why do they, quote unquote, why do they hate us? Why did this happen? Because people could not fathom any rational reason for such an attack. Mm. I wonder, because in the book you write, quote, after World War II, irrationality was passed on like a candle flame to burn one non-white adversary after another, the Chinese, Koreans, people of Southeast Asia, Muslims, and Arabs. I guess my question to you is, when it comes to casting America's foes or enemies as irrational, what disadvantage has that put the United States at by constantly using that thinking?
There is an interlocking process here. One is the failure of the intelligence apparatus. Then you move to the other level, and that is the failure of imagination. And that is where particularly non-Western, non-white, non-Judeo-Christian enemies are always seen as kind of queer and inferior and unlike ourselves. And there is a real failure to understand their grievances, to understand their intentions and to understand their capabilities. So the most interesting quote that I use in the book that I thought kind of encapsulates why does America get caught at Pearl Harbor unprepared? And the admiral who really gets targeted for being unprepared is Admiral Husband Kimmel. And during the Pearl Harbor hearings, Kimmel is sitting down having lunch with one of the lawyers. He says, Admiral Kimmel, tell me, really, why weren't you ready for the Japanese at Pearl Harbor? And Kimmel says, you want to know the truth, and I'm paraphrasing now, I don't have the quote in front of me. He says, I didn't think those little yellow sons of bitches could come that far and do that so much damage. The little yellow people. And you get the same kind of thinking about the Al-Qaeda and that, the little men with towels on their heads. It's almost a similar vocabulary, little men with towels on their heads. And I use cultures of war in this sense to throw questions upon clash of civilization, clash of cultures thinking.
I wonder if I might close with a couple questions that focus on, you know, where we are now, 10 years after the attacks on September 11th. Because I was very taken by a simple sentence that you wrote in the preface of your book. You had asked yourself about the culture of war itself and why it is always with us. And I wonder if you found an answer to that question.
I don't have an answer to that question beyond the fact that I guess by the time I had finished the book, I was very pessimistic. And I ended with quotes about human nature and about men at war and reflections about our technologies that enable us to do this kind of destructiveness more and more efficiently. Editors said, you can't end the book this way. You've got to end up with a little bit of hope. And I really agonized. And in the end, I came out pessimistic in the sense that for the period that I address in the book, from World War II until now, we have had war after war after war. America's been up to its ears in those wars. But it doesn't mean it was always on the wrong side, but in many cases it was a very destructive force.
Do you find any reason for optimism?
I find reason for optimism in people who I think are very brave and committed to fighting these trends. We're seeing reasons. We see now what we call an Arab Spring. We see incredibly courageous people coming up. And I at one point say we must think also about cultures of peace. We must think also about cultures of social justice, and those are the other studies. And I think you find hope in those individuals who are real heroes, and I think you find hope in those movements. But when you step back, the cultures of war in our modern society are overwhelming. But I think that we have those other cultures that are the hope for the future.
John Dower is Professor Emeritus of History at MIT and author of Cultures of War. Find an excerpt of his book at our website, radioboston.org.
All this week, Radio Boston is remembering September 11th. We're hearing the stories of men and women from around Massachusetts, those who lost loved ones, those who responded to that day. Mike Mulway is one man who responded to the attack in Lower Manhattan. On the evening of September 11th, he drove from Canton carrying portable electrical generators to help provide emergency power to the area around Ground Zero.
The first evening, Verizon Wireless brought what they call a cow. It's a cell site on wheels. Set it up at Ground Zero, literally 50 yards from the rubble pile, and we needed to provide power because there was absolutely no power in Lower Manhattan whatsoever. And the goal there was the communications just for the rescue workers. once we were able to establish power at that primary site, then the next site was 217 Broadway. The first thing we saw was just thousands of shoes all over the stairs. I mean, we were tripping over them. Remember, there was no lights, but we did have flashlights. We made our way up to the cell site, and we found it. It was on the fifth floor, and I came back down, and there was a police officer in front of the building, and I was like, what's with all the shoes? And he said to me, well, when the towers came down, these people were running for their lives, and they ran right out of their shoes.
Mike Mulway talking about his experience on 9/11. His company, FM Generator of Canton, continued to supply emergency power in Lower Manhattan until April 2002.
Up next, a conversation with the Massachusetts Teacher of the Year about what it takes to be the best and what it feels like to be the best and then lose your job. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.